40 years ago, the Dalai Lama was obliged to flee before the Chinese into India, and Zarong then rendered his master valuable service. He was for many years a cabinet minister and as first favorite of the Lama had virtually the powers of a regent. Subsequently, a new favorite named Kunpla dislodged Zarong from his position of authority. He was, however, able to retain his rank and dignities. Zarong was now in the third order of nobility and was master of the mint. His son was 26 years old. He had been brought up in India and spoke fluent English. Conscious of his own importance, he wore a golden amulet in his pigtail, as the son of a minister had the right to do. When this young noble came to call, servants handed tea and soon the conversation became lively. The minister's son was an incredibly versatile young man with a special interest in technical matters. He asked us about the latest discoveries, and told us that he had put together his own radio receiving set and fixed a wind-driven generator on the roof of his house. We were in the middle of a technical discussion in English when his wife interrupted us laughingly and said she wanted to ask us some questions. Yang Chenle, as she was called, was one of the beauties of Lhasa. She was well dressed and very soignée, and clearly acquainted with the use of powder, rouge, and lipstick. She was not at all shy, as was obvious from the lively manner in which she questioned us in Tibetan about our journey. Now and again she broke into our explanations with swift gestures and bursts of laughter. She was particularly amused by our account of how we had imposed on the officials with our expired travel permit. She seemed to be astonished at our fluency in Tibetan, but we noticed that neither she nor even the most staid of our visitors could forbear from laughing at us from time to time. Later our friends told us that we spoke the commonest kind of peasant dialect that one could imagine. It was rather like a backwoodsman from the remotest alpine valley talking his own lingo in a Viennese drawing room. Our visitors were immensely amused but much too polite to correct us. By the time this young couple left us we had made friends with them. They had brought with them some very welcome gifts, linen, pullovers, and cigarettes, and they begged us to tell them frankly when we wanted anything. The minister's son promised to help us and later delivered a message from his father inviting us to go and stay with him if the government gave us their approbation. That all sounded very consoling. More visitors came trooping in. Our next was a general of the Tibetan army, who was desperately anxious to learn everything possible about Rommel. He spoke with enthusiasm of the German general and said that with his smattering of English he had read everything available about him in the newspapers. In this respect Lhasa is not at all isolated. Newspapers come in from all over the world via India. The Indian daily papers arrive regularly a week after publication. There are even a few persons in the town who take life. The procession of visitors continued. Among them were highly placed monks, who courteously brought us gifts. Some of them became my good friends later on. Then there was a representative of the Chinese legation and after him an official belonging to the British agency in Sikkim. We were particularly honored by the visit of the commander-in-chief of the Tibetan army, General Kunsangts, who insisted on seeing us before leaving for China and India on a friendly mission. He was the younger brother of the foreign minister and an unusually well-informed man. It took a load off our minds when he assured us that our request for permission to stay in Tibet would certainly be approved. We gradually began to feel at home. Our relations with Thangm and his wife developed into a cordial friendship. We were mothered and well-fed, and everyone was pleased to see that we had such good appetites. However, doubtless as a reaction from hardship and overstrain, we suffered from all sorts of minor complaints. Orf Snater had an attack of fever, and my sciatica gave me a lot of trouble. Thangm sent for the doctor of the Chinese legation, who had studied in Berlin and Bordeaux. He examined us in approved European style and prescribed various medicines. It is probable that no other country in the world would welcome two poor fugitives as Tibet welcomed us. Our parcel of clothes, the gift of the government, had arrived with apologies for delay caused by the fact that we were taller than the average Tibetan and there were no ready-made clothes to fit us. So our suits and shoes were made to measure. We were as pleased as children. At last we were able to throw away our lousy old rags. Our new suits, though not up to the highest sartorial standards, were decent and tidy and quite good enough for us. In the intervals between our numerous visits, we worked at our notebooks and diaries. And we soon made friends with the Thames children, who usually had already gone off to school before we got up. In the evening they showed us their homework, which interested me very much as I was taking some trouble to learn the written language. Orff Snater had long been studying this and during our wanderings had taught me something, but it took me years to learn to write Tibetan more or less fluently. The individual letters present no difficulty, but their arrangement into syllables is no easy task. Many of the characters are taken from the ancient Indian scripts, and Tibetan writing looks more like Hindi than Chinese. Fine, durable parchment-like paper is used and Chinese ink. There are in Tibet several high-class mills, where the paper is made from juniper wood. In addition, thousands of loads of paper are imported yearly from Nepal and Bhutan, where the stuff is manufactured in the same way as in Tibet. I have often watched the process of paper making on the banks of the Kyachu River. The chief drawback of Tibetan paper is that the surface is not smooth enough, which makes writing difficult. Children are usually given wooden tablets for their exercises and use watered ink and bamboo pens. The writing can afterward be wiped out with a wet cloth. Thangs children often had to rub out their exercises 20 times before getting them right. Soon we were treated like members of the family. Mrs. Thang talked over her problems with us, and was delighted when we paid her compliments on her good looks and good taste. Once she invited us to come into her room and look at her jewels. These she kept in a great chest in which her treasures were stored either in small jewel cases or in fine silk wrappings. Her treasures were worth looking at. She had a glorious tiara of corals, turquoise, and pearls, and many rings as well as diamond earrings and some little Tibetan amulet lockets, which are hung round the neck by a coral chain. Many women never take these lockets off. The amulet they contain acts as a talisman which, they believe, protects them from evil. Our hostess was nettled by our admiration of her treasures. She told us that every man was obliged to present his wife with the jewels corresponding to his rank. Promotion in rank entailed promotion in jewelry. But to be merely rich was not enough, for wealth did not confer the right to wear costly jewels. Of course, the men grumble about their wives' pretensions, for here, as in the West, every woman seeks to outshine her rivals. Mrs. Thang, whose jewels must have been worth several thousand pounds, told us that she never went out unaccompanied by a servant, as attacks by thieves on society women were common. 8 days passed, during which we had dutifully kept indoors. It was a great surprise to us when one day servants came bringing an invitation to visit the home of the Dalai Lama's parents, and telling us to come at once. As we felt ourselves bound by our promise not to leave the house, we consulted a host. He was horrified that we should have any misgivings. Such an invitation overrode everything else. A summons from the Dalai Lama or the regent had precedence over all other considerations. No one would dare to detain us or later to call us to account. On the contrary, hesitation to comply would be a serious offense. We were glad to learn his opinion, but then began to be nervous about the reason for our summons. Was it a good omen for our future? Anyhow, we hurriedly prepared ourselves for the visit, dressing ourselves in our new clothes and Tibetan boots for the first time. We looked quite presentable. Thang then gave us each a pair of white silk scarves and impressed on us that we must present them when we were received in audience. We had already witnessed this custom in Kurong and had noticed that it was observed by quite simple people. When paying visits or presenting a petition to a person of higher standing, or at the great festivals, one is supposed to give presents of scarves. These scarves are found in all sort of qualities and the kind of scarf offered should be consistent with the rank of the giver. The house of the parents of the Dalai Lama was not far away. We soon found ourselves standing before a great gate, near which the gatekeeper was already on the lookout for us. When we approached, he bowed respectfully. We were led through a large garden full of vegetable plots and clusters of splendid willows till we came to the palace. We were taken up to the first floor, a door was opened and we found ourselves in the presence of the mother of the god king, to whom we bowed in reverence. She was sitting on a small throne in a large, bright room surrounded by servants. She looked the picture of aristocratic dignity. The humble awe which the Tibetans feel for the Holy Mother is something strange to us, but we found the moment a solemn one. The Holy Mother smiled at us and was visibly pleased when we handed her the scarves with deep obeisances, stretching out our arms to the fullest extent as Thang had instructed us. She took them from us and handed them at once to the servants. Then with a beaming countenance she shook our hands, contrary to Tibetan custom. At that moment in came the father of the Dalai Lama, a dignified elderly man. We bowed low again and handed him scarves with due ceremony, after which he shook our hands most unaffectedly. Now and then Europeans came to the house, and the host and hostess were to some degree familiar with European customs and not a little proud of the fact. Then we all sat down to tea. The tea we drank had a strange flavor, and was made differently from the usual Tibetan brew. We asked about it, and the question broke the ice, for it led our hosts to tell us about their former home. They had lived at Amdo as simple peasants until their son was recognized as the incarnation of the Dalai Lama. Amdo is in China, in the province of Qinghai, but its inhabitants are almost all Tibetan. They had brought their tea with them to Lhasa and now made it, not as the Tibetans do with butter, but adding milk and salt. They brought something else from their old home, the dialect they spoke. They both used a patois similar to that of the central provinces, but not the same. The 14-year-old brother of the Dalai Lama interpreted for them. He had come as a child to Lhasa and had quickly learned to speak pure Tibetan. He now spoke the Amda dialect only with his parents. While we were conversing with them, we took occasion to observe our hosts. Each of them made a very good impression. Their humble origin expressed itself in an attractive simplicity, but their bearing and demeanor were aristocratic. It was a big step from a small peasant's house in a distant province to a dukedom in the capital. They now owned the palace they lived in and large properties in the country. But they seemed to have survived the sudden revolution in their lives without deterioration. The boy whom we met, Lobsang Samten, was lively and wide awake. He was full of curiosity about us and asked us all manner of questions about our experiences. He told us that his divine younger brother had charged him to report on us exactly. We felt pleasantly excited by the news that the Dalai Lama was interested in us, and would have liked to learn more of him. We were told that the name Dalai Lama is not used in Tibet at all. It is a Mongolian expression meaning broad ocean. Normally the Dalai Lama is referred to as the Jyalpa Rimpok, which means treasured king. His parents and brothers use another title in speaking of him. They call him Kundun, which simply means presence. The holy parents had, in all, 6 children. The eldest son, long before the discovery of the Dalai Lama, had been recognized as an incarnation of Buddha and invested with the dignity of a lama in the monastery of Tagtsal. He too was styled Rimpok, the form of address applied to all lamas. The second son, Jalo Thundrup, was at school in China. Our young acquaintance Lobsang was destined for a monastic life. The Dalai Lama himself was now 11 years old. Besides his brothers he had 2 sisters. Subsequently the Holy Mother gave birth to another incarnation, Ngari Rimpok. As the mother of 3 incarnations she held the record for the Buddhist world. For the recognition of the Dalai Lama, see Chapter 16. Our visit led to cordial relations with this adaptable, clever woman, which were to continue until she fled before the invasion of the Reds to India. Our friendship had nothing to do with the transcendental worship that the Holy Mother received from others. But though I have a fairly skeptical attitude toward metaphysical matters, I could not but recognize the power of personality and faith with which she was invested. It gradually became clear to us what a distinction this invitation was. One must not forget that, with the exception of his family and a few personal servants holding the rank of abbot, no one has the right to address the god king, Nevertheless, in his isolation from the world he had deigned to take an interest in our fate. When we rose to leave, we were asked if we needed anything. We thanked our hosts, but preferred modestly to ask for nothing, in spite of which a line of servants marched up with sacks of meal and tsampa, a load of butter, and some beautiful soft woolen blankets. By the personal desire of the Kundun, said the Holy Mother, smiling, and pressed into our hands a 100 sang note. This was done so naturally and as if it was a matter of course that we felt no shame about accepting. After many expressions of thanks and deep obeisances, we left the room in some embarrassment. As a final proof of friendliness, Lobsang, on behalf of his parents, laid the scarves once more on our necks as we bowed to him. He then took us into the garden and showed us the grounds and the stables, where we saw some splendid horses from Soling and Hai, the pride of his father. In the course of conversation, he let drop the suggestion that I might give him lessons in some branches of Western knowledge. That coincided with my own secret wishes. I had often thought that I could manage to keep myself by giving lessons to the children of noble families. Loaded with gifts and escorted by servants, we returned to Thang's house. We were in high spirits and felt that now our fortunes were on the mend. Our hosts awaited us with impatient excitement. We had to tell them everything that had happened, and our next visitors were informed in detail of the honor that had been done to us. Our stocks rose considerably. The next day, when the brothers of the Dalai Lama came to visit us, our hostess at first concealed herself out of reverence and appeared only when the whole household had been mustered to greet them. The young Lama, Rinpoche, now 25 years old, had actually come from his monastery to see us. He laid his hand in blessing on each member of the household. He was the first incarnated Lama whom we came to know. People are accustomed to think of all Tibetan monks as Lamas. In fact, this name is only given to incarnations, and a few other monks distinguished by their ascetic lives or the miracles they have performed. All lames have the right to give their blessing and are revered as saints. Calm waters. 10 days after our arrival, we received word from the foreign ministry that we could move about freely. At the same time, we were supplied with the splendid full-length cloaks of lambskin for which we had lately been measured. For each of these, 60 skins were used. On the same day, we went for a walk in the town and in our Tibetan cloaks attracted no attention. We wanted to see everything. The inner town is composed of nothing but stores. Shops extend in unbroken lines and the dealers overflow into the street. There are no shop windows in our sense of the word. One finds numbers of general stores containing a large range of goods from needles to rubber boots, and near them smart shops selling draperies and silks. Provision stores contain, as well as local produce, American corned beef, Australian butter, and English whiskey. There is nothing one cannot buy, or at least order. One even finds the Elizabeth Arden specialities, and there is a keen demand for them. American overshoes, dating from the last war, are displayed between joints of yak meat and chunks of butter. You can order, too, sewing machines, radio sets, and gramophones, and hunt up Bing Crosby's latest records for your next party. The gaily dressed crowds of shoppers laugh and haggle and shout. They find a special pleasure in bargaining, which to be enjoyed must be long drawn out. Here you can see a nomad exchanging yak hair for snuff, and nearby a society lady with a swarm of servants swallowing for hours in a mountain of silks and brocades. The nomad women are no less particular in electing Indian cotton lengths for their prayer flags. The common people generally wear the nambu, a sash made of pure home-woven wool, which is practically untearable. This sash or belt is about 8 inches in width. Bales of material used for these nambus are displayed in the stores. The wool is either pure white or dyed mauve with a blend of indigo and rhubarb. The white nambu is hardly worn except by donkey drivers, as absence of colors is reckoned a sign of poverty. Since tape measures are not used here, they measure cloth by the length of one's arm. Thanks to my long limbs, I have always profited by this custom. Then we found an enormous store full of European felt hats, which are the Dernier Cri in Lhasa. A smart felt hat over Tibetan dress certainly looks odd, but Tibetans value broad-brimmed European hats as a protection against the sun. Sunburned faces are not an attraction here. Native Tibetan hats go much better with Tibetan dress and look more attractive in the street, and, in fact, the government was trying at that time to stem the influx of European fashions, not with any idea of interfering with individual liberty, but in order to preserve the beautiful native style of dress. The Tibetans are also addicted to umbrellas and sunshades, which you can find in all sizes, qualities, and colors. The monks are the best customers for these articles since, except at solemn festivals, they go bareheaded. When we got home, we found the secretary of the British legation waiting for us. He was a personal friend of Thangm, and his call was by no means an official visit. He said that he had heard much of us and was greatly interested in our journey and our experiences. He had himself been British trade representative in Gartok and knew something of the country through which we had travelled. We found him an opportune visitor, as we very much wanted to send news to our families at home, who must have long given us up for lost. Only the British representative had direct communication with the outside world, as Tibet does not belong to the World Postal Union and its postal arrangements are somewhat complicated. Our visitor encouraged us to apply personally for assistance in this matter, and so the next day we set out for the legation, which we had already noticed on our way into the town. Servants in red livery showed us first into the garden, where we found Reginald Fox, the wireless operator, taking his morning stroll. Fox had lived for many years in Lhasa and was married to a Tibetan lady. They had four enchanting children with fair hair and large black arm and eyes. The two eldest were at a boarding school in India. Fox was the only man in Lhasa who possessed a reliable motor, and in addition to his duties at the legation, he was regularly occupied in charging all the radio batteries in the town. He could communicate by wireless telephone with India and was much appreciated in Lhasa for his ability and thoroughness. Meanwhile, the servants had announced us, and we were conducted to the first floor of the building. The chief of the British legation greeted us cordially and invited us to a good English breakfast, which had been prepared on the veranda. How long it seemed since we had last sat on comfortable chairs and seen table decorations, flowers in vases, and books in a real European setting. We let our eyes wander in silence around the room. It seemed, somehow, as though we had come home. Our host understood what we were thinking. He died in the spring of 1953, in Kalimpong, India. When he saw us looking at his books, he kindly offered to let us use his library. Soon we began to talk freely. The question that worried us most, namely whether he still regarded us as prisoners of war, was tactfully avoided. At last we asked him bluntly whether our comrades were still behind the barbed wire. He could not say but promised to obtain information from India. He then spoke frankly of our situation and told us that he had been informed in detail of our escape and subsequent journey, and inferred that he had learned from the Tibetan government that we would soon go back to India. This prospect, we said, did not appeal to us, so he asked us if we would be interested to find work in Sikkim. We made no secret of our wish to stay on in Tibet, but said that if that was not possible, we would gladly consider his offer. The importance of the question we were discussing did not spoil our appetites, and with encouragement from our host we did more than justice to the good food we were offered. When we had finished, we thought the time had come to submit our request to be allowed to send word to our families. Our host promised to arrange for a message to go through the Red Cross. We were later allowed to send letters now and then through the legation, but for the most part we had to use the complicated Tibetan post, sending our letters to the frontiers in double envelopes, the outside one bearing a Tibetan stamp. At the frontier we arranged for a man to remove the outer envelope, put an Indian stamp on the inner one, and post it on. With luck it took only a fortnight for a letter to get to Europe. In Tibet the post is carried by runners who work in relays of 4 miles each. Along all the high roads are huts in which relays wait ready to relieve the runners as they arrive. Postal runners carry a spear with bells attached as a sign of their office. The spear can, if necessary, be used as a weapon, and the bells serve to frighten off wild animals at night. Stamps are printed in 5 different denominations and are on sale in the post offices. Our visit to the British legation had done much to relieve our minds. We had been welcomed there and had reason to hope that the English now realized we were harmless. On our way back, we were stopped by some servants who told us that their master desired us to visit him. When we asked who their master was, we learned that he was a high monastic official in the government service, one of the 4 Trunikimo, in whose hands authority over all the monks in Tibet is concentrated. We were taken to a large, stately mansion, scrupulously clean and well kept. One really could have eaten off the stone floors. The servants were all monks. We were greeted by a kindly, elderly gentleman and offered tea and cakes. After the usual courtesies, we fell into conversation and soon became aware of the reason why our host was interested in us. He stated frankly that Tibet was a backward country and that men like us could be made good use of. Unfortunately, everyone did not hold the same opinion. However, he would see what he could do and would say a good word for us. Meanwhile, he asked us what our professions had been in our own country and what subjects we had studied. He was particularly interested in the fact that Orf Snater was an agricultural engineer. No one in Tibet was an expert in this branch, and what scope there was in this great country. The next day we paid official visits to each of the 4 cabinet ministers. Responsible only to the regent, these men represent the supreme authority in Tibet. 3 of them are civil dignitaries and the 4th a monastic official. They all belong to the highest families and live in great style. We wondered with whom we should begin. We ought to have started with the minister monk, but we decided to bypass the protocol and call on the youngest minister first, Sakang by name. He was 32 years old and was considered more progressive than his colleagues. We hoped for counsel and understanding from a young man. He welcomed us with frank cordiality, and we were immediately on good terms. He was astonishingly well informed about events in the outside world. He entertained us at a princely dinner, and when we took our leave we felt that we had known each other for years. The next minister we visited was Kabshopa, a corpulent and somewhat self-important gentleman, who treated us with a certain condescension. He made us sit down on 2 chairs in front of his comfortable throne and then overwhelmed us with a flood of eloquent phrases. He punctuated his most effective passages by clearing his throat noisily, at which a servant hurried forward and offered him a golden spittoon. Spitting is not a breach of etiquette in Tibet, and small spittoons are placed on every table, but it was new to us to see one presented to the spitter by a servant. At this first meeting it was hard for us to know what to make of Kabshopa. He held forth, and we passively submitted to his eloquence, at the right time replying courteously to his politenesses. We drank the ceremonial cup of tea in exemplary fashion. As he had not realized that we spoke Tibetan, his nephew was asked to interpret. This young man's knowledge of English had secured him a post in the foreign ministry, and we often had dealings with him later. He was a typical example of the younger generation. He had studied in India and was full of plans for reforming Tibet, though he had not yet ventured to stand up for his theories in the presence of the conservative monks. Once when we were alone he caused me to remark that Orf Snater and I should have come to Lhasa a few years later, for if he and some of the other young aristocrats had been ministers, there would have been work for us in plenty. The minister monk who lived on the Lingkha, the 5-mile-long pilgrim's road that goes around Lhasa, received us with less formality. He was no longer young and had a nice little white beard of which he was very proud, for beards in Tibet are a rarity. In a general way, he seemed very detached, and in contrast with the other ministers avoided expressing any definite opinions. His name was Ranpa, and he was one of the few official monks who belonged to the aristocracy. The way in which the political situation was developing must have been causing him secret anxiety. He was much interested in our views on Russia's policy and told us that in the old scriptures it was prophesied that a great power from the north would overrun Tibet, destroy religion, and make itself master of the whole world. Finally, we called on Punkhang, the oldest of the four ministers. He was a little man compelled by short-sightedness to wear thick-lensed spectacles.